Lord above, we thank you that you're a God that is well in charge of everything, that there's nothing that goes beyond your responsibility and your capabilities in this universe. And as we study this book of Job, may we come to grips with that and understand those truths, even though from our perspective there may be a muddling of that thought in our mind where we look at our circumstances and can't see how you could be in charge. We have trouble trying to put our theology with what's practically going on. And so, Lord, help us as we go through this book that we would grow in our understanding of you and ourselves and the world that we live in. And thus we would be a little bit better prepared to meet some of the suffering and difficulties we will most definitely face. So we love you, Lord. Thank you for your word. It gives us light and gives us help. And we praise you in your son's name. Amen. When I went back in 1994 and 1995, I was working on a master's degree down in Greenville, South Carolina. And Tammy and I were recently married, and so we went to be a part of a church that was down there. And for Sunday mornings, they had a class that was being taught by an individual that had gotten his master's degree at Bob Jones University, but was working to pay off debts and to take care of his family of five kids. He had actually started schooling later than most did and the like. And he began to teach through the book of Job. And I could honestly say at that point in my life that I had never had someone go through the book of Job. You might have a sermon on a couple of verses and that's it, or the first and second chapters are, you know, chapters that have been run over a number of times as far as people dealing with, because it deals with the devil and what God allows and the like. But he began to work through that book, and I began to see that there were certain things that in that book that I had not taken in very well before as far as understanding the book. And long and short of it, I began to find out that the book wasn't all about suffering. Kind of go, well, who do you turn to when you want to study suffering? Well, the answer is Job will give you some comfort in this, but the book isn't all about suffering. And by the time I got done, I was like, you know what? This makes a whole lot more sense what's going on here and why this book was written, because it doesn't really seem to solve the problem of suffering completely. It gives us help, but it doesn't answer some of the questions we would like answered, though it does give us a more open picture of this. Thus, he entitled the series Beyond Suffering, because it's more than just about suffering in this book. And we'll talk about who the what and where in a few seconds here. He eventually taught that course several times, and he eventually wrote a book. He called it Beyond Suffering. And it's his study on the book of Job. And it is written by a man by the name of Leighton Talbert, same man that taught that Sunday school class. He's got another book that's excellent. It's called Not by Chance, which actually puts together divine sovereignty and human responsibility and does it in a very balanced fashion. It was his attempt to try and go, okay, let's balance this out. Excellent book. But this one is one that will help us in our study. It will be the framework that we'll use to go through this, because this is how I kind of think about the book of Job now, and it helps me to understand what it is like. But this book isn't all about answering all your questions about suffering, okay? I mean, it says beyond suffering on it, and you kind of go, okay, but he's going to say we're going to go beyond suffering and talk about some other things. I will say in our time here, I do recommend this book if you want a book on suffering. If I have people that go, can you give me a book for someone who's suffering? It's called When God Weeps. It's by a guy by the name of Stephen Estes, and the other person you more likely recognize, Joni Erickson Tada. She was an individual back in the 70s who was diving and ended up being paralyzed from the neck down. And if there's anybody who's known suffering all of her life, even thoughts of suicide and everything, I mean, you know, just gone through the whole gamut. You know, life completely changed, and it's never going back to the normal. How do you deal with that in a perspective that God would want us to have? She now has a ministry where she goes around and around the world and helps people see that, yes, you may be handicapped and paralyzed, but that isn't the end. Okay, there are things that you can do in this life, and you have the hope of the life to come if you know Christ. So she's been greatly used in this, and I like the title because it does say something. When God weeps. Okay, God does weep. You go, I don't know about that. Okay, you've probably memorized the shortest verse in the Bible. John 11:35, Jesus wept. Okay, Jesus, God, didn't just merely had, you know, a tear go down his cheek. You know, it just barely made it, but it's there. No, he wept. And he weeps over the city of Jerusalem. And you think about this, God does weep. So if you think God has no idea what it's like to suffer, the emotions of suffering, you forget that God wept. And so they deal with that and a lot of issues of suffering and aspects of it. She's a good author to read about it. Elizabeth Elliot is another one, goes by multiple names for the people that she was married to at the time, has this. So she's got some good books on suffering that direct you back to Christ and the scripture. But if you want, you know, immediate answers on suffering, more so than just, you know, we're understanding the book of Job and there is suffering that's a part of it, those books are good. Now let me ask this question of you, how many of you have ever had a series on the book of Job? Well, hopefully you remember this one if you have it. But most of the time you don't. You go, why? Because it's a long book. It's 42 chapters, okay? Which that's hefty material to try and work through, and if you don't understand exactly what's going on, it's a little bit difficult. And before we even get into the notes, I'm going to explain, and I think some of us can grasp this, but the structure of the way our Bible is set up. I mean, if you go and open your Bible, you start off in Genesis, and it goes right through to Deuteronomy, and those first five books are known as the Book of the Law, or the Pentateuch, the five books, the five teachings, and you say, what does it tell us? It's a mix of teaching and stories. And Genesis goes through the history of mankind to about 1440 B.C. You have the flood and the creation account, and then you have Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and his sons. And you get to all of that, you get to Exodus, and Exodus through Deuteronomy is about a 40-year time frame that you're dealing with in those books. And in that time, you have the nation of Israel escaping Egypt. They are given the law of God and how they're supposed to approach God and worship God, which is supposed to give them teaching and understand certain things about him while revealing their own sinfulness and a need for a Savior. You have that, and you get, you know, Leviticus, you know, that kind of is a teaching book, and you get to parts of Numbers, and you Deuteronomy, they're repeating the law over again. That's what it means, the second law. You're like, didn't we have this once before? Well, because he's dealing with a new group. So you have those five books. The next 12 books you have are all stories. They're called the historical books. You start off in Joshua, you go right on through Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, and those 12 books, though they're not in chronological order, there is some shifting on that with the stories. But the truth be told, as you read through it, you get a history of the nation of Israel from about 1440 B.C. till about 500 B.C. All sorts of stories. And that. Then you come to five books, and we know them as the books of wisdom, the wisdom books. And these are, in many cases, taking what you've been given as far as the law of God, living it out in real life, and the wisdom books are, as you understand, skill in living, living in real-time events with teaching that you have. How does that work out? How does it play out? And when you get to the books of wisdom, most of the time people think of wisdom and they think of the last chapter 10 on through the end of the book of Proverbs, where you can go and find one verse and it gives you wisdom and it gives you something really, you know, that you can mull over, and it's designed for that, for you to chew on for a while, each one of those parables. And it's written by the wisest man outside of Jesus Christ, though at times you look at his decisions and he's not really the wisest guy in some of his decisions. But he dispenses wisdom, and in chapters 10 through 31, you have 300 Proverbs of Solomon, though we know, had 3,000. Where Scripture tells us he had 3,000. We only have 300 in that. And then the first parts of this. And so that's kind of what we would like our wisdom to be like. You know, could we get it in bite-sized chunks, one verse, here's our wisdom, and we can have it. Proverbs does that. Psalms is a little bit more detailed. You can take a verse of the Psalms and get something to chew on like a proverb. But it's designed for you, for the 150 different songs that are there for you to read the whole thing. And you'll see repeated themes in each one and come to understand certain truths about God. And you read the stories. They're oftentimes titled with what story to attach them to. And you read that and you go, well, this is David's response to that and whatever. And you're kind of going, okay, this is a person responding in wisdom or responding in certain ways. And I'm gaining wisdom on how to respond myself. Song of Solomon, you just kind of go, what's that one? Well, the Song of Songs. Okay, because it is a song of a bunch of songs about love. And people have tried to find a pattern in that and work their way through it. And you get frustrated. You're kind of going, I'm not seeing this, because they try and see, you know, before he's married, while they're married, and after they're married. And you're going, some of those songs in the end don't fit with what's going on. You know, and it's just, it's almost like a collection. If you want poetry, you want songs about love, he's collected them, what it should be like. But then you get to Ecclesiastes and Job. And the difficulty with Ecclesiastes and Job is that you're not supposed to get just a single verse out of it and completely dwell on that, though you can in a couple of cases. The writer was intending you to read the whole of it and gain the wisdom from the whole book. Ecclesiastes, the wisdom is this. You want to live life without God? You'll be frustrated. Vanity, vanity is all is vanity. And you have, what's that? Life is empty, life is empty. It doesn't matter what you do, how happy you are, how sad you are, whatever it is. If you live life without God, you'll be miserable. But if you live in the fear of the Lord, then you see everything in the hands of the Lord. The times and the seasons that we have. That chapter 3 that has, you know, there's times for sorrow and times for joy. You go, what's that? Well, you have times in life where you're going to be deeply sorrowful and at times just greatly joyful. And there's everything in between. And we have to realize that every season we're given is given to us by God. You know, we may not choose that season at that time, but God gives it to us. So if we see this is something that's given to me by God, how do I live life because God's in charge? Then life's going to make more purpose to it. You live in the fear of the Lord as if he actually exists. And you get to the end of the book and you're going, okay, one day I'm going to have to stand and give account to him. So the whole end of the story is this: fear God, keep his commandments. Like, okay, I'll be happy that way, living life. You go, well, what's Job teaching us? Well, Job, once again, as I said, you don't want to go in and grab a single verse out of Job and stand on it. You go, why? Because sometimes it's completely out of context. You, first of all, have to figure out who's actually speaking, because if it's one of Job's friends, you're kind of like, they've got, I will say this, they do have, I'm going to give away part of it, they do have right medicine, but they're applying it to the wrong situation. Okay? You know, they've got good medicine in some cases. You're like, yeah, okay, they're theologically accurate and whatever. But what they're doing is they're applying it to Job, which it doesn't apply to. They're giving him the wrong medication. But there are verses in there that if you take them out of context, you're going to misunderstand what was actually being said. The famous one, when I am tried, I shall come forth as gold. Now, for us, we're going, you know, when God tests me in the fires, you know, in the end, I'll be like gold when it's done. That's not what Job's saying. You know what Job's saying? God, I wish you would come down here and take a look, because you'd find out I'm gold. You know, when he's tried me, he's looked at me, he'll find out I'm gold. You're kind of going, ooh, Job is basically saying, you know, I'm right, you're wrong, God. I mean, mean, that's in the context, if you read in context. And so what you've got to do is take the whole of the book and come to the conclusions that Job and whoever the author is wants you to come to. So it's not easy wisdom in the sense of I can just, you know, jump in there and get one bit of wisdom. You can, perhaps. But the way this book is given to us is for you to get the whole of it and understand what he's trying to get across. So that's why sometimes people, you know, don't understand Job. They come to Job and they want, you know, something quick fix. They come in, you know, I'm going to get answers to suffering. Well, yeah, you are going to get answers about suffering. The problem is they oftentimes look at the beginning and go, oh, Job, horrible. You know, everybody knows who Job is. This is a man who, you know, somebody has a bad thing. Oh, you know what? I think they can relate to Job. That's how we refer to him. But I think a lot of people are going, well, look at the end of the story. He gets all his stuff back and even more. So let's find out in between what we have to do in order to get all our stuff back. And you know what? That's not why Job's given to us, because there are sometimes things in this life that never change and never get better. And it's not that you're reading Job and going, well, what's the formula to understand suffering so that I feel better? You know, I get everything back later. So this is going to be, as we go through it, it will hopefully be helpful to us in understanding this book, and we will take it in some bite-sized chunks in the sense of not, you know, we're not going to, you know, come in and next week go, okay, the whole book in one sermon lesson. No, this is going to be more of a, you know, we're going to work through some of these men, what they're arguing for. And they're going to be right in some of the things they argue for. As we said, they're going to be applying it to the wrong situation. And we're going to see Job, who is right in many of the things that he says, but you're going to find out that he has got a wrong attitude. And he's going about it in the wrong way. So hopefully that will help us. So that's all introductory, okay? And we got this big introductory paragraph I want us to kind of look at when it comes to this book of Job and understanding what we're going to get out of this book. And it's got a little bit of meat to it. So here we go. Job is not a textbook of static doctrine, static teaching. I can say something in class and kids have no idea why it's so important. You know, the math teachers, the famous math teachers. You'll need this later. You know, 1 plus 1 equals 2. 1 plus 3 equals, you know, 4. Whatever. You go through, and it's like, you know, classroom teaching, whatever. And what kids don't like is the story problems. You go, why? Because now you're having to take the facts and go, let's apply it to real life situations. That's what we're talking about here, is that Job is not just merely presenting to us, here's the facts. It's saying, okay, here's the facts and how it works in a real situation, a real life situation of individuals who are suffering and others who are trying to figure out why people are suffering and answering those questions. And they're trying to work out what they would in a classroom go, this is what we know about God. This is what he's like. No, you're I can say certain things in a classroom that when you get out in the real world, you're like, I wonder if this really works. I believe God is always there. Okay, you go through a bad time, and what are you thinking? I don't think God's there. Okay, so what does my doctrine do? How do I figure out when it seems like God wasn't there? What went on here? Okay, so we're not talking that doctrine shifts. Okay, God's not shifting and this type of thing, but our circumstances change. And what we sometimes say about what we believe in a classroom setting changes when we, sadly, at times, the wrong direction, but sometimes it gets better. But when it hits real life, that we start going, okay, what is, you know, and how does this work out with God? The style and form intertwine the theological with dramatic and literary. We're going to get statements about God in the middle of a thunderstorm. As you read through the story, God's going to be talking right out of a lightning storm that's pretty powerful. Now, short stories recount the resolution of conflict. What we mean by short stories is that in short stories, you don't have a whole lot of character development. Okay, you don't have time for that. And it's sort of like watching a television show. 30 minutes is not a whole lot of time to resolve a situation, but they have some sort of story plot line and they come to a conclusion in the end. Okay, short stories are all about resolving the conflict. Not really a whole lot of character development. And that's kind of, you know, the problem of a lot of television is it's very shallow characters. You're just trying to get to the action and take every care of everything and it's resolved. What the book of Job is like, it's like a novel. And it's not so much that we're trying to resolve things in the end. We're looking at the characters and seeing how they are developed, how they change. And that's why we kind of say Job is like a novel. It traces the growth and transformation of a character in the middle of a conflict or a crisis. You're seeing Job change. And, you know, at times it's not good. I mean, Job, on a couple occasions, you're like, whoa, don't go there with God. But he, in his own situation and his reasoning, thinks he's okay with doing that kind of thing. And you get in the end, and I find this humorous, he's the guy who spends all the time talking. If you look through and you measure out the chapters of who's doing the speaking, Job gets the most speaking time. But in the end, when God shows up, and God says, do you have anything to say? You know what he does? He says, I'll put my hand over my mouth. I'll let you do all the talking here. You know, he's the one who's been filling the air with words, but you get to the end and he's just kind of like, I'm going to be silent now. That's development. He's not the one. God gets to do the talking. So there's a transformation of character. So Job kind of reads like a novel, and it doesn't completely resolve everything. Does Job ever find out that God is having a contest with Satan? No. He never finds this out. You know, he goes back, he prays for his friends, and then God restores some things there, and he doesn't know that he is just answered God's question to Satan. He had no idea. So not everything is resolved for or character in the way that you would like him to be. Now, it's an organic whole, an unfolding drama that uncovers new facets of the central supernatural character, and it's God. Okay, there's two main characters of this book. I mean, we could name Job God rather than Job. Because it's really about God, because in the end, who's the one who gets the final say? God. Okay, I mean, that really is the case. But you have this supernatural character, God, who is working behind the scenes and reveals the spiritual metamorphosis. You go, what's that? You have a person, you know, think about the term metamorphosis. You have a caterpillar turning into a wonderful butterfly. Well, here you got Job, and he's one way at the beginning, and by the time we get done, he's transformed into something else that's much better. I mean, and in many ways, you think about it, how could he get any better? He's a man who's described as perfect. He eschews evil. He does what's right in every situation, seemingly so. How does he get any better? He does, which is a sign that we're always always ready for improvement as Christians and followers of God. But you have this metamorphosis of Job. So really, it's a story about God. And a story about Job. Okay, you've got two main characters, but understand this. God's not being developed. He's already got all of his characteristics. He's already always what he's going to be. Job's the one that we're seeing change in the light of being in contact with the one character, and that's God. Now, what's the structure of the book of Job? Okay, we could get in all the little details of the back and forth and whatever and that, but here's a very easy structure for the book of Job if you want to know what's going on. Remember the log cabin structure. Log there, L-O-G-U-E, is the idea of speech or word. Okay, the Greek word is logos, a word. This is kind of where it comes from. But there's a log cabin structure. You go, well, what's the log cabin structure? What do we mean by that? Well, it goes this way. You start off and you have a prologue. You go, what's the prologue? It's like the foreword, same kind of idea. Prologue, the pro-word, the pre-word. And you read in chapters 1 and 2, it's written in prose. You go, big deal. You're having a story there. It's a narrative. Okay, there's nothing flowery about it, just a story, facts being told about what's going on there in the first two chapters. And what's being done there is that we're getting the setup for the story, because the main part of the story is not Job's suffering at the beginning. It's just setting it up on the tee, going, okay, here's what's happened, and now the story, chapter 3. Let's get into what the wisdom is. And so you have this pre-setup, pre-word, pre-discussion, setting the scene, whatever you want to call it, in chapters 1 and 2. And so then you go, okay, what's next? Well, you have a second log, and it's this. Dialogue. Dialogue is between the word dia, two words, so you have two people talking back and forth, and you have dialogue. It's a conversation. And as you read through this, you have Job talking. I mean, it's amazing. We sometimes miss it that his friends actually sit there for 7 days and don't say anything. So they have all this talking, but do you realize they went 7 days without saying anything? So really what we're getting is, you know, what's been sitting in their head this whole time, and as they talk about this, it suddenly comes pouring out. But when you read it, it's Job, and then you got Eliphaz. And Eliphaz answers what Job says, and Job re-answers what Eliphaz said, and the next guy comes along, and that's Bildad. And you have Bildad, who says something about Job. Job responds to Bildad. And then you have Zophar, who says something about Job, and Job responds to Zophar. And then we go back again. It's Eliphaz saying something, and Job responds, and Bildad says something, and Job responds. And Zophar says something, and Job responds. And they're going back and forth and answering questions and putting something else out there. You get to the third cycle, and it's Eliphaz says something. Job responds. Bildad says something. Job responds. Zophar doesn't say anything. You go, why? Because at that point, he's just like, you know, he's the fiery-tempered guy. You know, he's like, he's the one who's very practical, and he's just like, you know what? Fine, you aren't paying attention to a single thing we are. I'm not going to say anything else. And Job kind of stops and waits for him, and it says Job keeps talking. He's waiting for Zophar to say something. So he just starts talking. But then you get to an individual in chapter 34, if I remember correctly, my thing outline here. You have a man by the name of Elihu that you didn't even know was there. And all of a sudden, he just starts talking, and nobody answers him because he's a spokesman for God. He's the youngest of the group, and he just starts talking. And it's really not a dialogue there, but what you could put after this here, or you could put it before and probably do it, is human dialogue, okay? People talking and people listening. You know, that's the conversation thing. And so you have this dialogue, goes back and forth, and it's all in poetry. And I will tell you this, it's hard to see this. Some of the versions of the King James that you have will divide it out into prose and then show you poetry. A lot of them don't. A lot of the new translations and versions do actually help you see the fact that there is, okay, this is poetry. It's set in a different way, and you have that. And it helps you understand your Bible a little bit more when you realize, especially like in Jeremiah. Jeremiah is a book that goes back and forth between poetry and narrative, poetry and narrative. It's just back and forth. And for us, it's kind of hard to see that. Well, all of those chapters are in poetry, which is amazing, because here these men are speaking in poetry, discussing suffering. These are not unintelligent guys. These are some of the smartest men of the day that are discussing with Job. So this is a, you know, a really impressive conversation. You have monologue. Okay, what's monologue? One person talking. No one else gets to say anything. It's like in a play where you have all the characters talking to one another on the stage, and then all of a sudden the character comes up to the front of the stage and starts just talking to the crowd. They have a monologue. They give a speech of some kind while no one else is doing anything. But you could put here in the front or at the end here, this is divine monologue. God's the only one talking. No one else is responding. And he gets to give a multitude of words and discuss certain things, and no one else talks. It's all poetry. It's very beautiful poetry in some cases, as far as just reading it, and even in our language we can understand it, the structure on that. And they get to the epilogue. You go, what's the epilogue? After God talks, by the way, Job, prays for his friends, and he gets everything back, and that's the end. It's sort of like, I put it this way, it's sort of like, I just watched a documentary that National Geographic just put out. It was on JFK's assassination, and they have people that were there that are still alive. So they're interviewing them along with the events that happened there. And at the end, okay, so we're talking about the JFK and assassination and those two or three days that are there in that time frame. And they get to the end of the program, and they show pictures of the individual, and the one individual, they say he was a Secret Service agent, and they just simply showed a picture of him and said, 6 months after the JFK assassination, he quit being the Secret Service. There's a man, you hear him, he said he's in tears the whole time this takes place. He's just in devastation over this. And another person, it just says, they lived and started a business and that. If you've got good biographies or good history stories, they will oftentimes at the back go, what happened to these people after these events that took place here? That's kind of what Job does at the end here. He kind of goes, okay, it's all over. You understand certain things about God, but by the way, we'll just tell you what happened to Job. Human interest, what went on beyond this. And it tells us that. It's the closing word, the epilogue there. It's written in prose, so we're back to storytelling and whatever, and that's it. So you kind of go through narrative, two stories about God and Satan and bad things happening in Job, lots of poetry where people are talking back and forth to one another, and then you've got this prose at the end that just kind of finishes up the details of what's happening for Job. And that's it. So that's the structure, the very simple structure of Job, but I think it's a good way to think through this. Now, authorship and date of the book Job. Okay, who wrote Job? Quick answer, no one knows. Okay, could have been Job, maybe. And somebody goes, well, it has to be Job because he knows all the events here. Understand, you got Moses who writes about all sorts of stories that he wasn't there for. Finally inspired, so you don't necessarily have to have someone in that time frame writing the story of Job. So we don't really know. There's no indicator in the book, none. When was it written? Well, either 2000 BC or 950 BC. And you go, why the two differences there? Well, it could have been written when it happened. Or it might be because it's a wisdom book written in the time where you get all the wisdom books. What's that time? The time of David and Solomon. So we get all our wisdom literature for the most part, even though there's a few that go beyond that time frame. And so there's some people that go, it may have been written in 950 BC. But I will say this, going through all of that, indicators of when it actually took place, the historical setting, when did this story take place? There is a geographical backdrop. We can figure out where some of these characters are from. Job's friend, one of Job's friends, comes, we believe that Job lived on the eastern side of the Jordan River. If we have our geography correct, one of his friends comes all the way from Babylon area. He's not nearby. He's way far away and comes and visits him. And you got a couple of people that, the Temanite, you go, what's that? Teman is a city in Edom. Okay, so you have people that are friends there. So we kind of can guess it's in the land of Israel, sort of, but probably on the eastern side of the Jordan River, not the western side, which is mainly the land of Israel. We do have some background that we're told, the people's names and relatives that we can trace down. The economy is based on agriculture. You go, how do you know that? We're not told that Job has lots and lots of gold and silver. What are we told? Job is rich in the world at that time, and he's got lots of camels and goats and cattle. He's got everything. The camels are luxury items, so that, he's got lots of those. His wealth is based on agricultural things. So we're dealing with societies that are not, you know, so industrial, they're more agricultural, and time frame would be there. This to me is the tip off, really. The father is priest. After 1445, no one's supposed to be a priest except for Aaron and his family, the tribe of Levi. Those are the ones who can worship God and lead in that worship after 1445. Before that, who did it? Head of the family. We have accounts of this. We read in Abraham's life. He comes back to the land and he sets up an altar and praises God. Isaac does this. Jacob does this. And that was the way that God did this. The leader of the family was the spiritual leader and intercessor. And you have in the story, Job, and the first story, his children go out to have a party at somebody's house. He's hit home. He's offering sacrifice in case they do something to sin against God. He's offering a sacrifice to atone for that sin, whatever it may be. So he's serving as the priest. So we're looking at a time before the nation of Israel as a nation, you know, in Exodus, exists. So it's got to be before that. It's got to be more in Genesis time frame. Lifespan is lengthy. When they start talking about lifespan in this book, you got some really old people in this book, and you're kind of going, well, when did that happen? Early on, before book of Exodus, you got people who are living 200, 300, 400, 500 years old. So you have that. And so I say this, that Job probably lives around 2000 BC, not necessarily contemporary of Abraham, because one of the characters seems to be a relative of a son or a grandson of Abraham, if the family line is right. So he may not have been, may have been a contemporary of Abram, Isaac, possibly, Jacob, somewhere in that time frame. So I go with that. So when you get asked, what's the oldest book in the Bible, everyone will go, Genesis. It could very well be the book of Job, because Job is dealing with stuff that was before Genesis was ever written in 1440 when Moses was writing these books. It could be the oldest book in our Bible. So we don't know. But we do, most people will lean to the time frame that it's about 2000 BC when this story takes place. So somebody contemporary to Abraham and Jacob, patriarchs. Now, one thing I'm going to suggest before we get into the study, and we'll be done here this evening. And, you know, it's kind of hard to get into this without knowing what the book's like. And I will say this, I'm going to ask you to try and read through this book, but they're going to give you some unique ways of reading the book. You don't have to do all of these. You don't have to do any of them the way that they're suggesting. But I would say, as we come to this and understanding Job, we've got 20 lessons or 22 lessons, I'm trying to remember. It would be beneficial for you to have read through this sometime in that time frame, just to get the flow, so you're not coming in and going, okay, pastor's, you know, spoon feeding this to us, and you know, I walk out and But here is some suggestions. It's given, Leighton gave some of these in his, and I just kind of worked from there. I suggest for you to read through Job, if you can, in one sitting. It, for average reading, it would take about 2 hours to read it. Okay? And why you read it through all at once, I'll give you a comparison to this. And it's a comparison he gives, but I understand this just because I have a daughter who's music background, so, you know, and I like some of that music. So I can listen to a Beethoven symphony for 15 minutes a day. And I'm going to listen to Beethoven symphony number whatever, 5. And so, you know, you listen to this, and after 15 minutes I go, you know what? Okay, got to go something else. I'll come back to it tomorrow, finish it off. Well, I won't finish it off because it goes longer than that. If I remember correctly, it's something like 45 minutes long or something like that. And guess what? I'm going to forget some of the details that, you know, from the day before that I'm like, wait a second, this music has got the same kind of tones going on that we just had. I'll miss that because I don't listen to the whole thing at once. Now, can I listen to the music and break it up into sections, the four different movements that are there, and just listen to them that way and get something out of it? And the answer is, yeah, I'll understand certain things. I'll remember certain tunes out of it. But for you to get the full impact of it, you got to sit down and listen to the whole thing at once for you to get some of the things going on in the music there and the like. So it is, it ought to be that way with some of the books that we read. We typically read our if we're reading the Bible regularly, we got our reading charts, and it's like, okay, I get one chapter today, one chapter tomorrow, one chapter the next day. And that kind of breaks things up. The suggestion here is that you just kind of go, okay, sit down and read through the whole thing. In 2 hours, wow, that's a lot of time. You know, we can find 2 hours if we really want to. If you really, really want to, you can. You're like, no, you don't understand my schedule. Yeah, you can. I'm just saying, we all know our schedules, and we know that we could be more profitable if we were really trying. So you read it in one setting. You kind of go, you'll pick up things that you may not, or just reading it otherwise. Read, and this is one way to do it, read aloud. Now, you go, I don't know. Well, when you start reading it out loud and trying, because when we read it in our own, you know, just read it, you're reading words, whatever. When you read it out loud, you start putting the emotion into it. Let me give you an example. Job 15, okay? I'm just going to read this for you, okay? Then answered Eliphaz the Temanite and said, okay, here's what he said. Should a wise man utter vain knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? What is he saying there? I've just heard a bunch of hot air. So how would he say that? I mean, he's not going, let's have this nice little talk here. No, he's frustrated. Job, you just spent this whole time beforehand, and you have filled it with, the east wind is the hot wind, and we've used this statement today, somebody's got a bunch of hot air. You're going, well, it's not effective. Okay, so he says that, and you're kind of going, ooh, it's getting tense here. We'll get to the next chapter where Job responds to what Eliphaz says in that chapter 16. He starts this way. He says this, and Job answered and said, I have heard many such things. I've heard a lot of things like what you said, but guess what? Miserable comforters are y'all. You people are, you're like the person in the hospital when a person's got a broken leg and they're trying to move them around and they end up stepping on the person's broken leg, while they're trying to take care of them. And he's just like, that's what you're like. You're miserable comforters. You're attempting to comfort me and you're making it worse. But reading it out loud, you kind of get the sense of tension here in some passage. It's not that we're having this nice dialogue. It gets tense. I mean, Zophar, as we said, throws up his arms, doesn't even talk. I'm done. He's not going to pay attention. So maybe reading aloud. Read sympathetically. What do you mean, read sympathetically? Why are Job's friends there? Okay, you say it's custom. They would show up and you'd sit with a person after somebody died. This is just kind of what they did in that culture. And they still, in some cases do. You bury the person on the day and then the morning is afterwards. Visitation's after the burial. Why are Job's friends there? Well, they're there to find out why Job, who is the best person that they know, is suffering under the hand of God. And they're trying to figure out, what did you do? Because they're thinking this, I don't want to do what you did. Now, I'm looking at you sitting here covered from head to toe and boils, and you've lost everything, and I don't want that to happen. So let's find out what you did. And you go at times, they're not really sympathizing with Job. They are in some ways because they're going, what did you do to get to this point? And we don't want to be there. We understand just observing you how bad it is. And then you look at Job and you're just sitting here going, here's a man that is responding to God, and you're going, oh, you shouldn't be saying that to God. You know, we can say that, and you know, we're here and go, you know, he shouldn't have said that. Okay, but had you just lost all 10 children in one day? You know, so this is not just merely a story that you read and it's, there's, if you read it with sympathy, you begin to understand some of the passion that comes out in the story. Sympathy is the idea that you have passion or pathos with somebody, and you ought to read it that way. I mean, these men are seriously trying to figure out what Job did, and Job is trying to explain, I didn't do anything. Don't you understand that? And so there is some passion going on here. So read it that way. And then these other two we'll go through. Read in a different version. Kind of go, okay. If I had my druthers, I'd tell you, read it in Hebrew. But I want you to read through the book of Job in your lifetime, so don't do that, okay? But there are times where you read other versions that try as faithfully as they can to connect with the Hebrew and Greek, that put it in a different kind of English than what you're used to, and you reading through it, you're going, you've read it the same way for 40, 50, 60 years, and you suddenly read it in that, and you're going, whoa, is that what I've read for 50, 60 years, and that's what's actually being said there? So I say that because you can, you know, it changes your perspective on some of the passage that you're so familiar with to hear the same word, but it's a different word, and all of a sudden you're like, wait, is that what it means? Is that really truly what it means? And I will say this, there are good versions out there and there are garbage versions out there, okay? I'm just telling you that. They've taken theological bents that you shouldn't, but there are some versions out there that are faithful to Greek and Hebrew, that you ought to do that sometime, okay? Last one, simply this. Read, and you kind of go, what in the world? Read synoptically. Okay. I would say this. In each chapter, you ought to paraphrase what is being said there. Can you do it in one or two words, one or two sentences, what that, you know, 30-verse statement by Eliphaz, what's he arguing for? And when you read the statement in response to Job, can you, in one or two sentences, go, Job is, you know, saying, I did not do this. I wish God would come down so I could argue with him. And that will help you narrow down what's going on in the back and forth. If you're thinking this way, could I synopsize, what's going on here, and paraphrase it? What's going on here? What did they just say? In my own words. And narrow it down to just a sentence or two, what they took a long, lengthy time to suggest, you just kind of burn it down to a smaller thing. And that will help you read through this book too. So these are all suggestions on how to read through the book of Job and get a more full effect of this for it. So next week we'll come back and we'll start into the issue of suffering. That's, you know, obviously a major topic in here, and just talk through this next week along with several other details on that. Any questions? Okay, as we've gone through this, things pop in your head. Yes?
Is there a different version you would recommend, because there's so many out there? I know, and you don't have to answer.
I had this question this morning. What do you recommend as far as a version? I said, you know, this is a loaded question. I'll tell you, the ones that I will at times do for devotional reading myself, and it's because I trust them, I don't feel like I've got a philosophical bent that is wrong. New King James, what they've done is they've gone through, they've taken out the THs and put in S's. They put you instead of these and thous, so that is a good way, and that, you know, is effective in the sense of getting you to think a little bit differently. The New American Standard is one that I have to say before the 2020 version came out. If you read the 2020 version, they decided that they were going to translate God and all the verbs and things as gender neutral. Before that, it was probably the translation that they would tell us as theological students. It holds closely to the order of the Hebrew and the Greek. And that, it reads a little bit more difficult, but it's closest to the, if you want to read it in the order that it was in the Hebrew and the Greek, read that. So I have to, you know, put that down going, they've did a philosophy change. I do not, you know, I do not condone that because it says he and that, and to suddenly go, it's gender neutral, you're pandering to a doctrinal philosophy that is wrong. The ESV, yeah, people are like, you know, the ESV was originally RSV. They've gone through and corrected the errors of the RSV. RSV was a liberal translation. They've gone back to the Greek and try and fix it. It actually reads much like the King James Version. When you read through the ESV, you'll just kind of find that it's got that flow that you're familiar with in that. So those are the ones I would, you know, typically read as an ESV, NAS, the old NAS, New King James, and that's what I'll use. I get a question about the NIV. I've always kind of had a problem with the NIV because they initially did some interpretation issues. Rather than giving you the word, they would make up interpretation. They thing called dynamic equivalence, and I won't get into what it is. So it wasn't quite, you know, getting you as close to the Greek and Hebrew and English as it was. They were making interpretations for you. But they were one of the first Bibles to then, they introduced a TNIV, which is the gender neutral, you know, let's get, you know, we don't want have he and that referring to God because then it sounds patriarchal and whatever. So there are some versions out there, and there's other ones that people are trying to translate from Greek and Hebrew, and I've not read them. I've not had time to read them. But those are the ones that I, you know, reading through, you look at the Greek and Hebrew and you're kind of going, okay, this, they're trying their best to stay as close to this, and not, you know, taking it a direction that would be theologically incorrect. So, yeah, I had that question this morning too. And I can give you a lengthier explanation of this, and there's all sorts of other issues behind it. There's Greek, you know, Greek and Hebrew text, which ones do you choose, whatever. But, yeah. In most conservative circles, you'll find people going, those versions are fairly safe, though some of us are stronger, you know. I still think King James, because that's what I memorized, grew up on, that's what I think like. But yeah, it sometimes helps to just kind of read it in a different one and go, what? You know, New King James, what? You know, I mean, in that, there are times where you're reading that, you're just kind of like, and I've read this for years and didn't understand that's what it meant. So, yeah. Anything else? Any other questions?
Just a comment about the reading aloud. I found years ago that, like, when you go through something like Chronicles, when it's just all these names and stuff, and reading aloud makes you focus more too, your mind doesn't tend to wander as much, so that I think that's an excellent.
Yeah, you can, I mean, I can burn through the genealogies in about a minute if I want to. It was like, oh, look, all these names. Okay, next one. You know, not that all those names are going to theologically change my life, but they're there for a reason. And sometimes we can just, you know, poof, go right through it without even thinking. Yeah. It gets really interesting when you get to Joshua and you got all the place names and that, you know. For the inheritance. Yes?
I have a couple of questions. One is, we said it was written between or 2000 BC or 950 BC.
Mm-hmm.
When you mentioned after 1445, that's also BC?
Yeah, it's BC, yeah, 1445 BC. 1445 is a very solid date. There, you know, there'll be some that will say it was 1200 BC, but that's taking a liberal view of what the Bible says. But 1445 is when the nation of Israel left Egypt. We know that. There's pretty solid evidence for that. There are some that say 1200, but then you start getting into some of your dates then in the Bible are way off and the like. So 1445 is just kind of a point where you just go, okay, we know what happened there. Israel's leaving Egypt. Okay, Moses has this 40-year time span to write. So that's why I'm saying 1445. That's kind of a key time there in our Bible.
The question I have is, the father was a priest. Mm-hmm. Who is the father of Job, or Job himself?
Well, Job is the head of the family. He's got 10 children. So he's the priest for the family. He's offering the sacrifice. And that's very common in the times of Abraham and those, for the father of the family, for the children to be the priest. And that was one of the privileges of being the leader of the family. Steve?
I didn't really understand the distinction between prose and poetry.
Prose is, just think of Joe Friday, just the facts. It's stories. You're getting the details of what happened in the story over and over and over again, okay? Poetry is flowery language. So it's not, you know, it's not stating it the way you would want. I mean, I used this illustration this morning. Terry would probably be able to tell me what story this is, but I don't remember. There's a poem about a fly on a wall. Is there? Okay, it's not ringing any bells with her. But there's this poem by the fly that's on a wall, and it, you know, and you read the whole thing, and you get done. It has nothing to do with the fly on the wall. You're like, there's a fly on the wall, and whatever. And, you know, me being the very, you know, I'm a historian. Give me the facts, okay? You know, and you're like, you know, it's representing something, you know, it's representing something else. Okay. Typically, when you get to poetry, you're getting something that's, you know, it's much more flowery. It's got a lot more, you know, depth, allusions when you read poetry. That if, you know, just stated the facts, it would be a whole lot easier.
Prose is
narrative. It's telling a story. You know, it's laying out facts. Whereas poetry is intentionally at times trying to be very descriptive, abundant and descriptive terms and comparisons and the like, whereas prose is just, you know, just facts. Anybody else? Okay,